Look, it's Monday, April 13th, and the world is currently a lot to handle. We've got a government shutdown that's actually starting to bite, a massive geopolitical scenario unfolding in the Gulf, and some serious political shifts in Europe. It's one of those mornings where the official version of events and the actual reality are starting to drift pretty far apart. Following up on the tension we've been tracking in the Middle East, the podcast's Second Order Liner Notes is walking through what a total blockade of the Strait of Hormuz would actually look like. In this scenario, the White House orders a complete halt to traffic in the Strait, following a collapse in negotiations with Iran. This isn't just a localized naval maneuver. We are talking about the primary artery for 20% of the world's oil supply. While a two-week ceasefire was technically declared in the real world, the podcast argues it's essentially a ghost agreement. Fighting continues between Israel and Iran-backed militants. If Iran asserts physical control over the strait while the U.S. maintains it is open, it creates a massive disconnect between official rhetoric and the reality on the water. Here's the thing. Even in a simulation, the damage to the global energy market is already baked in. Analysts are projecting a national average gas price of $3.70 per gallon for the year, and that's the optimistic version. We've entered a new paradigm where the mere threat of a blockade creates a risk premium on energy that isn't going away. Not for nothing, but the U.S. military has burned through so much hardware and munitions in recent standoffs that the administration is now forced to go to Congress for a massive supplemental funding request just to replenish the shelves. Speaking of Congress, they are walking back into a building that is functionally on fire. The Department of Homeland Security is currently under a record-breaking shutdown. The mechanics here are a mess. The Senate has passed its version of a DHS budget, and Republican leadership there basically says their job is done. But over in the House, the GOP is fractured. Speaker Johnson is dealing with a razor-thin majority and a conference that can't agree on whether to take the Senate's deal or hold out for more aggressive provisions, like the SAFE Act. It's a classic DC deadlock. The House is waiting on the Senate is waiting on the House, and the DHS remains dark while the country handles a major geopolitical conflict. This isn't just a headache for bureaucrats, it's becoming a massive electoral liability for the Republican Party. Vice President J.D. Vance's failure to secure a resolution in the Iran talks means the GOP is heading into the midterms tethered to an unpopular war and spiking energy prices. We're seeing internal fractures in the MAGA movement because of it. High-profile influencers like Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene have started publicly criticizing Trump's handling of the conflict. When you lose the people who buy the ink, you're in trouble. Democrats are already seeing the benefits in special elections from Wisconsin to Georgia by focusing almost exclusively on affordability, which is political shorthand for everything is too expensive because of this war. While the U.S. focuses on the strait, the broader global economy is starting to look like a Jenga tower. Global imbalances, the gap between what countries earn and what they spend, are re-emerging in a big way. The U.S. is currently running a massive current account deficit, largely because we don't save enough and we spend too much. The administration's primary fix has been tariffs, but the data suggests they aren't working. While tariffs act as a tax that could theoretically help the budget, they're being offset by concurrent tax cuts. It's like trying to drain a bathtub while the faucet is running full blast. The fix isn't a mystery, but it is politically toxic. For this to stabilize, the U.S. has to cut the budget deficit and fix entitlements. China needs to stop hoarding cash and actually get its citizens to spend money on services. Europe needs to stop being so thrifty and actually invest in its own infrastructure and defense. If these three don't coordinate, we aren't looking at a soft landing. We're looking at a crisis-driven resolution where interest rates spike globally, putting immense strain on a U.S. economy that is already drowning in debt. If you want to see what happens when the public finally gets fed up with illiberal governance and systemic corruption, look at the current projections coming out of Hungary. The podcast is analyzing a potential political earthquake where Prime Minister Viktor Orban could be ousted after 15 years in power. Orban has been the poster child for the illiberal democracy model, the guy who showed the world how to dismantle the judiciary and the free press while still keeping the veneer of a democracy. The focus is on Peter Magyar, an opposition leader who is currently polling with massive momentum on a singular punchy platform, anti-corruption. While an election isn't live today, the podcast is modeling what a two-thirds majority win for Magyar would look like. This would be a massive blow to the global nationalist movement that saw Orbán as a blueprint. In this scenario, Magyar has the unenviable task of trying to dismantle the oligarchy Orbán spent a decade building, an intricate web of cronies who own everything from the construction firms to the media outlets. Brussels and Washington are watching this closely, because Hungary could go from being the EU's primary internal saboteur to a potential test case for how you actually restore a democracy. Back in the Persian Gulf, the landscape is shifting in ways that might be permanent. For years, the Gulf states, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, operated under the assumption that the US was the ultimate guarantor of security. That assumption is dead. Despite all the US military hardware in the region, they couldn't stop the conflict from reaching the Gulf's doorstep. Leaders in the region who aligned with Trump, hoping to avoid entanglement, now find themselves in the middle of a war that threatens their entire economic future. The Gulf states are trying to diversify their economies away from oil, investing in tech, tourism, and finance. But it's hard to build a tourism hub when there are drone threats against your skyscrapers. We're already seeing a shift in how these cities are being planned. Architects in Dubai are literally rethinking the use of glass-heavy designs because of the threat of aerial attacks. Economically, these countries are now pouring money back into defense to replenish their own systems, which means less petrodollar capital flowing into U.S. treasuries and global real estate. If that money dries up, interest rates in the U.S. go up. It's all connected. On the corporate side, we are officially entering the gauntlet of earnings season. This week, the big banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, are opening their books. These reports are going to tell us exactly how much the average person is struggling with these energy prices and interest rates. We're also watching Taiwan Semiconductor and Netflix. Netflix recently hiked subscription prices and is leaning hard into advertising. Their numbers will be a canary in the coal mine for whether consumers are finally hitting a wall on discretionary spending. While the CEOs talk, the Federal Reserve will be listening. We're getting the Beige Book this week, which is the Fed's granular look at the economy across the country. Key officials like John Williams and Christopher Waller are scheduled to speak. Williams usually signals the higher-for-longer interest rate stance, while Waller is the wild card who moves with the data. If the data shows inflation is sticking around because of the regional instability and the war, don't expect those interest rate cuts everyone's been praying for anytime soon. Finally, looking at the strategic landscape, the U.S. is currently caught in what analysts call an escalation trap with Iran. The podcast points to a concrete development. India and Japan are starting to distance themselves from U.S. policy because Iran controls the oil they need to survive. This shift anchors the analysis from Robert Pape, which suggests the U.S. is currently playing a losing hand. For decades, the U.S. has operated on the idea that we can bomb Iran into submission. But Iran has spent those decades burying its nuclear sites and critical infrastructure so deep they are essentially invulnerable to airstrikes. Every time we hit them, it doesn't degrade their capability. It just strengthens their domestic support and their resolve. We are currently at a tipping point. The U.S. is facing a choice: either enter a full-scale, incredibly costly ground war, or accept that Iran is emerging as a fourth global power center. The U.S.-led coalition in the Gulf is fragmenting as regional powers look for new security guarantees that don't depend on a distracted Washington. It's a shitty situation, honestly. We're watching a systemic breakdown in leadership and accountability, where partisan narratives are being prioritized over factual reality. Whether it's Pete Hegseth's father dismissing military accounts of drone casualties, or the partisan divide over misconduct allegations against people like Eric Swalwell and Donald Trump, the truth has become a secondary concern to winning. But as the DHS shutdown shows, you can't spin your way out of a physical reality for very long. So, while the world is arguing over borders and oil, the office landscape is having its own existential crisis. the way we work is about to look less like a ladder and more like a circuit board. According to recent reporting from Block & Every, the traditional middle manager, the person whose entire job is basically routing information from the top to the bottom, is becoming obsolete. Block is pitching a top-down architectural vision where the company itself is treated as a single intelligence. In this model, a centralized world model fed by customer data handles the coordination, feeding context directly to individual contributors. Meanwhile, Every is seeing a bottom-up shift. They've observed that when employees use personal AI agents, those agents start to specialize and form a shadow org chart. These agents end up handling the inter-team pings and status updates that usually clog up a manager's calendar. The takeaway here is that both perspectives agree on one thing. The information routing manager is dead. If your value add is just being a human relay station, AI is coming for your desk. It's a shift from human-centric coordination to intelligence-driven systems. This leads humans to handle the edge cases, the weird, messy problems that don't fit into a data model yet. Honestly, it sounds great in a slide deck, but Every points out that it's currently a mess in practice. AI agents are currently prone to ant death spirals in group chats where they just loop or fail, requiring a human to step in and play adult in the room. While we're talking about powerful models, the podcast is discussing a rumor that Anthropic is keeping a next-generation model, internally nicknamed Mythos, behind closed doors. As reported by various outlets, Anthropic is withholding this frontier model from public release because they've deemed it too dangerous for general use. They're claiming this is about responsible deployment and identifying vulnerabilities before a bad actor can weaponize them. But look, there's a flip side to this safety-first narrative. By keeping the most capable tools in-house, we're seeing the birth of a new kind of digital divide. If only elite organizations and the ultra-wealthy have access to this level of intelligence, we're not democratizing technology. We're just hand-delivering a massive competitive advantage to the people who already have everything. This contrasts sharply with OpenAI, which has faced heat for being less transparent while simultaneously pushing a global industrial policy that suggests taxing AI gains to fund public wealth. It's a weird moment where the companies building the tech are also trying to write the tax code for the world they're about to disrupt. Speaking of the plumbing of AI, Sanity is making the case that the future of these agentic workflows depends entirely on how we structure data. The news here is the rise of managed connection protocols, or MCPs. These are essentially standardized plugs that let an AI agent talk to a backend without hallucinating. The logic is simple. An AI is only as smart as the data it can actually read. If a company's info is a mess of unstructured PDFs and Slack threads, an AI agent is useless. Sanity is pushing for an API-first content backend where everything is treated as pure data. This allows an AI to, say, update a pricing page and have that change ripple through every channel automatically. It's the unsexy foundational work that actually makes the AI revolution functional, rather than just a series of cool demos. Finally, we have to talk about the galaxy brain problem in Silicon Valley. There's a growing skepticism toward the narratives being spun by guys like Sam Altman and Elon Musk. There's a pattern of using existential risk as a brilliant fundraising tool. By claiming AI might literally wipe out humanity, these founders create a sense of urgency that helps them secure billions in capital. Built-in points to Elon Musk's boring company as a prime example, using a tunnel boring machine as a narrative device to build hype for a future that hasn't really shown up yet. The concern is that we're repeating the mistakes of the social media era, but with much higher stakes. Back then, the narrative was about connecting the world, while the reality was a degradation of public discourse. Now, the race for AGI is being driven by the same move-fast-and-break-things ego. But the thing being broken this time could be the global power grid or the very concept of shared truth. We're already seeing AI-generated fake news, like fabricated CNN clips of Jake Tapper, that can fool even the smartest people in the room. If the people building this tech are more interested in being first than being safe, we're heading toward a recursive loop of degradation, where AI trains on its own garbage until the truth is impossible to find. It's a shitty situation, frankly, and one that suggests the biggest risk isn't the AI itself, it's the guys holding the remote. Of course, if you want to see a different kind of ego-driven chaos, just look at how the NFL is trying to take over your TV. The NFL is currently sucking the oxygen out of the entire media landscape, and it's starting to piss off just about everyone, from the DOJ to the people paying for Peacock. Here is the situation. As the NFL gears up for its next round of media rights negotiations, the league is aggressively moving more games to streaming platforms. That shift is creating two major problems. First, the Department of Justice is looking into whether this violates the 1961 Sports Broadcasting Act. That law gives the NFL a very specific antitrust exemption for league-wide deals, but it was written back when streaming meant a creek in the woods. If the DOJ decides the NFL is overstepping that exemption, it could blow up their entire negotiating strategy. The second issue is the NFL tax. Because the league's rights fees are skyrocketing, broadcasters like Paramount are being squeezed. They're spending so much to keep football that they have almost nothing left for non-sports content. According to recent reports, spending on non-sports programming is flat or declining across the board. Look, we've all noticed the quality of everything else on cable is cratering. This is why. Networks are terrified that if they lose the NFL, they lose their ability to charge cable companies retransmission fees, which is basically the only thing keeping the lights on at this point. The strategy right now is a mess. Some networks are trying to lock in deals early, while others are gambling that by 2030, the NFL's leverage will actually drop because fans are getting tired of being behind five different paywalls. It's a classic bully in the schoolyard dynamic, and the NFL is the one taking everyone's lunch money. Switching gears to the people actually running these teams, Peter Kenyon, the guy who helped run Manchester United, Chelsea, and now Williams F1, is out here arguing that genius managers are a myth. He calls his model the Holy Trinity framework. It's a rigid division of labor between the owner, the CEO, and the manager. The news here isn't just that he likes structure. It's that he's actively pushing a ruthless approach to longevity. At Chelsea, Kenyon famously pushed for the firing of Claudio Ranieri, despite the team performing well, simply because Ranieri didn't fit the long-term vision of becoming the best in Europe. It's a cold-blooded way to run a business, but Kenyon's argument is that you have to insulate the coach from the business side so they can focus entirely on the pitch. It honestly sounds like a corporate HR manual disguised as a sports strategy. But considering the chaotic way most owners run their teams based on a fan mentality, he's probably right. Finally, if you own a digital marketing agency and you're looking for an exit, there is a massive wave of private equity money, about $1.5 trillion, sitting on the sidelines. But there's a catch. Buyers don't care about your revenue if you're still the one doing all the work. The big trend in agency acquisitions right now is founder independence. If a buyer sees that the founder is still the main person handling sales or client calls, they're walking away. They're also looking at AI, but not the way you think. They don't care if you're using ChatGPT to write captions. They're looking for agencies that have built custom AI models to lower their cost of delivery and increase margins. Basically, if your AI strategy is just a browser tab, nobody is buying your company. The takeaway for the startup crowd is simple. Build the business like you're never going to sell it. Ironically, that's the only way to make it look like something worth buying. All this high-level strategy is fine, but it doesn't mean much if you're too burnt out to actually execute. The Rethink Productivity podcast just announced they're expanding their training lineup through Rethink Academy, including new courses on workload modeling and introduction to productivity. They're focusing on the fact that when you screw up your workload models, you end up with idle staff at one location and massive queues at another. They pointed to mobile phone stores where customers spend over an hour on a transaction, mostly because the staff is buried in administrative bullshit instead of actually talking to the person buying the phone. Look, it's a classic case of back-end efficiency, or the lack of it, bleeding into the customer experience. If your check-in process at a hotel is a disaster, it doesn't matter how nice the pillows are. It's a good reminder that productivity isn't just a corporate buzzword for making people work faster. It's about fixing the friction that makes everyone, including the customer, want to scream. Speaking of friction, a recent report on habit formation argues that your willpower is basically a lie. Habits are just automatic responses to environmental cues, context, routine, and reward. The data shows that Vietnam veterans who used heroin overseas often stopped immediately upon returning home because the environmental triggers were gone. The takeaway here is that if you want to change your life, don't try to be stronger. Just change your habit feng shui. Make the junk food hard to reach and put your gym clothes in the middle of the floor. Your brain is lazy. You might as well use that to your advantage. Finally, there's a new framework making the rounds about building a happy operating system. The core idea is that happiness isn't a personality trait you're born with, but a posture you choose. It posits that feelings actually follow actions, not the other way around. It's a bit fake it till you make it, sure, but the framing is interesting. If you don't have any problems, you've probably stopped participating in life. Frustration isn't a sign you're failing, it's just proof you're still in the game. Which honestly, is a pretty decent way to look at a shitty Monday. And if you're in the game of Fantasy Premier League, you've probably got more than enough frustration to go around right now. The focus for Fantasy Premier League managers this morning is the looming Game Week 33 deadline and a messy set of decisions regarding the bench boost and free hit chips. The big news on the pitch is the status of Nico O'Reilly. He's currently dealing with a potential injury that makes him a massive doubt for the upcoming fixtures against Arsenal and Burnley. This is a headache because O'Reilly was a staple for managers planning to use their free hit chip this week. If he's out, the podcast suggests a pivot to a Manchester City attacker like Phil Foden, or a defensive shift toward Bournemouth's Hill or Senesi. Honestly, if you don't have a free hit and he's missing both games, the math says you probably have to sell him. Holding on to an injured player while everyone else is chasing double game week points is a fast way to tank your rank. Speaking of selling, there is a major debate over what to do with Arsenal's Gabriel. He's facing Manchester City away, which is a defensive nightmare. For those playing a bench boost, the podcast suggests selling him for a Leeds defender like Pascal Struick, who has much better clean sheet odds against Wolves. However, there's a catch. If you sell Gabriel now, you'll likely want him back by game week 35, when Arsenal's schedule improves. It's the classic FPL trap, burning two transfers on the same guy, just to chase a few points in the short term. It's annoying, but with Leeds and City projected for the highest clean sheet potential, the numbers say it might be worth the hassle. On the offensive side, Manchester City, Chelsea, and Bournemouth are the projected heavy hitters for goals this week. For managers who feel their squad is a total wreck, the move is to trigger the wild card now. This is specifically recommended if your team looks weak for game week 34, or if you're carrying dead weight like Eberechi Eze. A wild card draft right now should lean into a triple City attack and look at players like Dominic Calvert-Lewin or Diogo Jota to replace guys who have lost their starting spots. If your team is actually in decent shape for next week, the consensus is to use the free hit instead. This lets you load up on high upside differentials like Chelsea's Mark Cucurella or Brighton's Pascal Gross without ruining your long-term structure. One thing to watch, Brighton's Kaoru Mitoma is seeing inconsistent minutes, so even with a double game week, he's a massive gamble. Look, the reality here is that a lot of managers are coming off a disastrous game week 32. Some reports are already showing wildcard teams trailing non-wildcarders by significant margins. To fix that, you need to find about 27 points over the next 2 weeks. It's doable, but it requires being cold-blooded about players like Gabriel and O'Reilly. If a player isn't nailed to start or has a ceiling of 2 points, they're just taking up space. Get them out. Before I let you go, here's a quick run through everything else that's moving the needle. Stablecoin issuers are basically running a massive pro bono lending scheme for the US government. They're taking global savings and dumping them into short-dated treasury bills, which helps fund our deficit, while the people actually holding the coins get zero interest. It's a brilliant way to keep the dollar dominant, even if it feels a little like a legal grift. If you're planning on inheriting the family home or leaving one behind, start talking now. Joint ownership is a fast track to a family feud if half the siblings want to sell and the other half want to turn it into a shrine. It's an asset, sure, but without a plan, it's mostly just a very expensive headache. In the world of fantasy football, stop drafting purely on average draft position and start looking at the actual human beings involved. Taking a guy like Puka Nacua early feels great until his documented injury history or off-field chaos catches up with him. Burning a high draft pick on someone who might spend half the season on the bench is just a shitty way to spend your Sunday. And finally, iRobot, the Roomba people, spent a decade obsessed with military and government contracts before they ever thought about your living room. They almost went broke trying to be engineering purists instead of just admitting that people really just wanted a robot to vacuum their floors. Turns out, it cleans the rug is a much better business model than it might find a landmine. So, that's the world right now. Gas is getting expensive, the government is closed, and your robot vacuum was originally designed to detect IEDs. Good luck out there today.